And action. Okay, who forgot?
Welcome to the Stack Exchange Podcast, number 12, attempt 6.
Okay, he said it is. Can't even have a podcast. Jeff, what's new with you this week? Stack Exchange Podcast 12, go.
Well, I think it's a continuation of the stuff that we talked about last week. As far as what's happening on the Stack Exchange Network, the mobile support that we have, which is now getting quite good, was always quite good.
So we pretty much officially launched mobile support.
Yeah, we had a private beta, then we have a public beta. We just kind of deployed it without telling anyone and saw what happened and asked for feedback. But then we announced it on the blog, so now it's officially sort of official that if you're on a device that is a small screen device, you should get a special version of HTML that's much faster and more appropriate for a 3-to-4-inch screen rather than the desktop version that we had before. So that's working pretty well.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that we deployed was inline editing. So if you have...
it's very Web 2.0.
Sorry, little interruption there. If you have a post on the screen that you want to change, you click edit. This you don't have to do a post back. You don't have to go to another page on the internet. The edit happens sort of right there on the page.
And does it make like yellow that fades away when you submit it?
Kind of. There's some fade to go on. It's just typical jQuery type stuff. But it's very slick. It does make it very, very fast to edit things rapidly because we want to incentivize editing. So those are really the two big things. And those are kind of the same from last week, but those were big changes. So I encourage everybody to check those out.
I just went in today and edited a whole bunch of questions on the Apple Stack Exchange. The titles. This is my new job in life, is making titles like literate. It's kind of interesting because there's like a million questions. For example, half of the time the question is like, why can't I do X, or how would I do X? And you could either phrase that as how do I do X, or how do you do X, or how does one? Like, it's not so easy to figure out exactly like what the tone should be in the titles when you actually try to attempt to make them consistent in some way. But if you look at the homepage,
sex in the title, you know, just exciting.
If you look at the homepage of Apple Stack Exchange right now, first of all, you'll see that I've edited every single thing on the homepage, and secondly, you'll see that there are no longer any spaces in front of the question marks. Everything's a question. It's all grammatical. It's all got consistent capitalization for the most part.
Right. Well, titles are a big deal. I mean, that's the one area where I kind of frown on titles that. Small edits to posts, but I don't mind a small edit to a post that changes a single word in the title. I totally approve of that because titles are so important to get right.
Yeah, it just makes the front page of the site look more literate. And we have, by the way, I don't know where we're going to edit this thing, but for those of you that came in after we chopped off the beginning of the podcast, Patrick McKenzie is here with us, who you may know from Hacker News and other internet sites as Patio 11. He's the creator of Bingo Card Creator. So you're the bingo card creator. Did I say that right?
Or yeah.
Should I just kill myself now?
That's pretty meta, though.
Yeah. And you have Patrick, you have a new app for scheduling dentist appointments.
Yeah, it's more for giving reminder calls to people or reminder SMSs.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Appointment Reminder because I'm cheap, appointmentreminder.org, because that was $8.95 instead of $20,000.
Wow. Anyway, the other thing about editing the titles, which is why I wanted to introduce Patrick there, because Patrick is sort of, you know, one of the world's experts on doing things that search engines can recognize and find. And so obviously our titles are a major component of what search engines see about our site, and what they think a page means comes from analyzing the search engines, the titles. Bah. So one of the things that I'm being careful to do with the title, actually, is not to change any of the choice of words, unless it's like literally illiterate. If somebody used a particular choice of words, for example, if they said my iMac freezing intermittently, right? So the freezing and intermittently, I could change that to, you know, crashes occasionally or seizes up often or whatever. But you know, part of our goal is actually to occupy the mental space on the questioner's side, if that makes any sense. So
totally.
we're trying to get answers to specific questions, and you may have a group of people that don't know the word freeze, and they say my computer, you know, seizes up, And if somebody asks that question, then we want it to be found as seizes up, because essentially we're trying to get every question the way it's worded so the search engine has a chance of finding it. What else? What was another example of that? You know, a lot of times it comes from like, what is this thing? You know, like people have different words for describing things, or, you know, one of the questions that people are having comes from the fact that they don't actually know the terminology for that thing that they're experiencing.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that it's sort of a running gag when I report questions my customers have had for me is that many don't know the word browser, because most of my software is software as a service these days. You get to it through a browser. And the most common sort of organic way to describe browser is, quote, the Googles. So, you know, I open the Googles.
Wait, the Googles?
The Googles.
Where do they get the plural version of that from?
I don't know. But if you talk to, without loss of generality, most of my customers are like later 50s females. So if you talk to them, you'll hear about the Googles all the time. I open the Googles. And then I, you know, clicky on the purple thing, and then I get taken to my bingos, but dot, dot, dot.
That is sort of a weird thing of using my to refer to something that is not yours at all, actually. Mm-hmm. And then I went to my Google, and I...
Patrick, that's interesting that you... So for the bingo card, no. Are you still doing a lot of bingo card stuff, or is that like in the past?
The software still exists. Lots of people still use it. It's largely in maintenance mode, which is basically, you know, I answer support emails from customers and I cut checks to freelancers, and that's about the extent of my involvement. Like, there's no major, you know, bingo card creator 4.0 that I could conceive of writing, because it just doesn't make sense to me right now.
I liked that story, and I'm sure this will be in the show notes, but the bingo card stuff was really fascinating, because it was, I think, a good example of programmers tend to build programmery things. You know, like we built Stack Overflow, which is obviously deeply programmery, and Stack Exchange is our attempt to sort of deprogrammer it a little bit. But it's just interesting that what I loved about that story was that you started with something that was so unprogrammery, like bingo cards. Like, what programmer says, you know what I really love? Bingo, right? And you just used it as a case study. It was almost like the MacGuffin. It was like the thing that isn't really the thing to talk about this, like, how do you make this a business? How do you make X a business where X is like a widget? I really enjoyed that part of the story. And then another side effect of that is you get an audience that's very unlike, you know, even Joel, even for Fog Creek audience. I mean, that's like IT and small business. And this is like, you know, women in their 50s. It's like, how do you,
how would you
making the connection
audience
with your audience is really tough. I mean, it's a really interesting challenge that you took on there, Patrick.
Well, it's funny. I don't know if I would have an audience in the same sense that you guys have an audience. Most of the people who find out about me are in very kind of goal-directed mode. Like, they want to play, you know, Halloween bingo tomorrow, and so they search for Halloween bingo, and they find it because I'm very effective at SEO for that. But there isn't, like, a group of, you know, 20,000 teachers who are tuning into me every week to hear the latest and greatest in, you know, classroom bingo innovations. But one of the nice things about...
What on earth is Halloween bingo? Good heavens.
So imagine you have a room full of, like... You've got a room full of sugared up fifth graders who they've had their candied apples. They've been given candy. They're starting to eat lots of it in class, and they are hyped off the walls. And you want to have something that, you know, they are theoretically in a public or private school and are theoretically in instructional mode, but realistically, no work is getting done that day. So you play a game with them, Halloween bingo, where each cell on the card has a different Halloween vocabulary word. And then you tell them.
Good.
I don't know,
Google
jack-o'-lantern, and then they get some reading practice on finding the word jack-o'-lantern, and then the first two fill up five in a row, column, or diagonal wins, and then you give them even more candy. That's Halloween bingo in a nutshell.
Yeah. I see you've got halloweenbingocards.net.
Yep.
And the title is Halloween Bingo Cards, and it's got a nice description. It's got a meta description. Printable Halloween bingo activities for you to enjoy. It's number 4 on Google after some spam, it looks like. It's some kind of garbage that's up here.
Yeah, it's typically around number 1 in October, but I haven't built any links to it for a while. So I own a bunch of these, like, you know, they're called exact match domain names among SEOs. An exact match domain name is when the query, if you strip out all the spaces, exactly matches the .com, .org, or .net domain name that you own. If you're an exact match domain with respect to that exact query, you get a huge, huge bonus. Like, Typically, the thing that determines who ranks for very competitive searches is who has the most links or the links containing that anchor text. But if you have an exact match domain, you kind of punch above your weight. So like if Harvard University, which is one of the most trusted domains on the internet, published Halloween bingo cards, they probably wouldn't beat this domain.
Wow.
Now, so that was totally true. A year ago, I haven't built a single link for it for a year, so it's starting to fall a little bit in the rankings. But if I was to, I don't know, lean on two of my buddies and say, hey, could you blog on your blog that Halloween bingo cards exist at this domain name? Or if I put a link to it prominently from my blog, it's kind of likely I would get back up to...
All right, Alex is taking care of that for you. You don't want Thanksgiving Halloween cards or...
Could you do Halloween instead?
Halloween.
Tell me whatever you want. I'll put in the show notes X blank bingo cards and I'll anchor text that to you.
Oh, Halloween bingo cards, please. So do you have like a sense for how big the Halloween bingo card market is? Because if you don't, this will blow your mind.
No, but okay, I really want to know now.
Okay. I would say it's about $2,000 a year.
Okay, so it's about 300,000 people who search for it. Wow. 300,000. And if I ranked number one consistently for like the entire month of October, that would be worth like over $20,000. Last year it was only worth $8,000.
That's pretty decent.
All right. Yeah. And who how do you monetize on that? I'm assuming it's just advertising, or do you charge for the service?
Oh, heck no. I charge money for value. No, it's like, I'll give people up to 15 bingo cards of whatever they want free. But most teachers don't have 15 students in the classroom. They have 24 or they have 27 or whatever. And if they want to print more than 15, then they have to pay me $30. And that's my entire business model. Like, parents can get it for free because most of them don't have 16 kids. Teachers have to pay me $30.
Fair enough. Soak the teachers. Well, we have, a long time ago, I had this theory that you could have, millions of people all having the same question, but they're phrasing it in different ways. They use different words and different terminology to kind of express it.
Yeah.
So are they actually moving offices right now during the podcast?
I mean, why would you not move an office around during the actual podcast?
This is the worst podcast ever.
This actually can be super entertaining for people watching the live stream because they're just going to see an endless parade of our sales team walking by, like carrying filing cabinets and books and computers.
One thing I wanted to mention, Patrick, is I was reading that the Google had actually changed. One of my big beefs with a lot of the Google results was this hoisting of domains that just happened to match the thing you're searching. Way, way above the norm. Like, I mean, I guess that made more sense when domains actually cost money to buy.
Don't mean to step over you, but I think you might be conflating two things. Like, there's the exact match domain bonus, which is, that there's an actual bonus there. And then what a lot of people see, they see spammy domains with like a hyphen in them or something. And it happens to match their keywords, and they think, oh, they're giving that hyphenated domain a bonus. They're not. It's just that, like, the person who thinks the hyphenated domain is getting him a bonus is also doing some other SEO stuff that actually works. So if you
hyphen is a negative, or the hyphen turns off the exact match bonus or something?
Right. You get no exact match bonus for hyphenated domains because, you can create like an infinite number of hyphenated domains or domains with like a number in them or whatever. And so then that only proves that you were able to spend $8, and $8 isn't a good signal of quality. But if you were the first person on the internet to a particular concept, you're probably, fairly authoritative for that. Or you've paid someone else a whole lot of money. Like, you guys are either you're authoritative for Stack Overflows, or you were, you found the guy who registered StackOverflow.com first and paid him like an absurd amount, is Google's like no knowledge hypothesis of it. So with regards to Stack Overflow, you should be more valuable, I guess, than any like random Stack Overflow all hyphens .co. Which that just proves somebody paid $2.
We dominate Stack Overflow questions on Google. But
there's an exact quote here I want to put out. It's from SEOptimize.com, spelled the European way, by the way, not the Z, yes. And it says, and I quote, exact match domains. For years, so-called exact match domains, e.g. SEO.com, for the query SEO have been the best bet to rank quickly and stay on top. The good times seem to be over, however. They don't, unfortunately, a typical SEO article, they don't provide a lot of data backing up.
Yeah, these guys, it's so easy to be an SEO blogger. You can just make crap up and nobody has any way of testing it.
But I really would be glad to see this, because I think I would say half of the problems I saw, and Google has addressed some of this with Panda and some of the stuff they don't post Panda, but a lot of it was just like, I remember searching for an iPhone 4 case was the worst experience I think I've ever had, because at all these exact domain matches that just sucked. They were like, oh, yeah. iPhone4case.com, iPhone 4 this, and they were all total crap. You know, it was almost like matching in the domain was a better indicator of sucking than actually helping me. So I was really bitter about that. You know, I was glad to see, but that's the reason I brought it up. It wasn't just me randomly. It was me randomly pointing to another random SEO thing.
Let's try it now. What was it? iPhone 4 case? Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah. This was around Christmas, though, which apparently there's a lot of complaints around Christmas because...
Yeah, those sites are gone. There's nothing. There's not a single one that has that domain name on the first page of the Google results.
This is a big change, because I swear to you, the last time I did this, it was like, iPhone 4 this, iPhone 4 this, iPhone 4
Yeah,
this.
Yeah. You're right. Honestly, a lot of those, I think that Google... Oops, sorry, I talked over someone.
Yeah, since the 4 will kind of, like, numbers don't really count for exact match domains, usually, and don't take this as the absolute gospel truth. This is just my understanding of it. So it's probably, again, that they weren't ranking on the strength of that domain. It was just a bunch of people who they knew there was a huge market opportunity and they SEO'd using anything they could think of. And in a new huge market opportunity where there's nobody legitimately ranking for it already, you're going to get the, you know, most savvy black and or grayish hat SEOs on the front page. Like, because, you know, they raffle stomp over somebody who just did a blog post, which happened to be like, you know, tangentially related to iPhone 4 cases 30 minutes ago.
I think that Google now incorporates the Whois data for a domain as to who actually owns the domain. So if when there's somebody that owns a million bad domains that are all problematic, that can sort of carry on a new domain they've never seen before will be born with a negative just because it's owned by Demand Media or eHow or one of those companies.
Yeah, they've been doing that for a while. They previously had, especially with regards to like pure spam, they had internal tools where they could kind of like trace the network based on things like, say, registration data or co-located IPs or footprints within the code. Like a lot of black hat spammers will have a network of blogs that are all run the same WordPress themes and WordPress plugins. So you can imagine like algorithmically footprinting out their entire network of 203,000 different sites and then burning it all at once. That's like SEO lingo for cause to disappear from the indexes, burn. So
yes, the Google death penalty.
The Google death penalty. They can burn people too. There's at least one or two people. No, like,
hey, we had lunch there the other week. It was totally, totally innocuous.
Burn people to lunch. I'm not getting the connection.
Yeah, there was no burning of people. I was at the Googleplex. They were not really burning anybody on the Googleplex that we were there.
No. I mean, like, there's somebody
that's spy lingo. Spy lingo. Haven't you ever watched Burn show? Come on, Joel. Get with it, man. Yeah.
Joel's CIA credentials have lapsed.
Yeah, clearly.
Yeah, the idea is like you can give someone a. Basically, in order to get off the internet, like any project that you were associated with for henceforth is not going to be loved in the eyes of Google.
How do they know that you're based on what? Based on your ownership of a domain or your name in the comments in the CSS file or?
Based on, you know, you've been reported by a competitor in their all-purpose report box that this is actually owned by, you know, evil SEO number 67. And if they think that's likely to be true, they just hit the magic burn button on it.
You're supposed to do this algorithmically, not with human intervention.
Yeah, Google, that they go both ways on that question, depending on when you ask them.
They don't. If it were the case that they were making individual human decisions, they would then be held accountable for those decisions, and so they don't want you to think that they are.
Mm-hmm. I definitely think there's. They're very good about the PR messaging on that and a lot of other things. I should mention, like, I love Google with like an asterisk. Like, I think they're the best company in the world and they've done more for, you know, the average human being than any other company in the last 20 years. Asterisk. they're probably not as good with a capital G as they think they are. And that's the asterisk.
All right. Well, what do you think about question titles? Like, one thing that I've been doing here is rewriting everything to be a full question, like how do I ? As opposed to just a couple of keywords, which is what people have been using. Is that going to penalize us or help us, or does it not matter, or do you not know?
Hard to tell. So personally, in terms of user experience, I would like to see, you know, actual English on the page when I look at it. In terms of things on the title, so in addition to just getting, like, you know, keyword bonuses for things in the title, they're actually going to be echoed on the SERP search engine result page. So you're thinking, when this shows up, it's going to be competing against like 10 blue links. And what can I put in the title such that it makes most likely that my site gets the click versus one of these other sites getting the click?
So a well-written full English sentence question is actually likely to be easier to read and easier to scan and just seem friendly and helpful. And you'll
say, And you also, like, I don't have data to substantiate this one, but if you do product searches, you're going to get a lot of things where it's like, you know, name of site, bar, product keyword, bar, cheap, product keyword, right? And so when you look at a search engine result page that has 8 results that look like that, it's clear that, all these 8 guys are in the box of probably not going to be too valuable for me. And then you have one other thing that's kind of the... it's the only guy looking different on the page where it's clearly an actual human talking about it. So I might go with the human first. Now, I don't know if that's average user behavior. That's the other asterisk thing. Like, there's the what is it, 1-10-90 rule, where 1% of people create the content and 10% of the people interact with the content, and then 90% just passively consume the content. I don't know that the people who write questions are the same people who ask questions to their friendly neighborhood Google. it might be worth, like, seeing, for example, if you think natural language is the best thing for titles, like, try that on some sample of questions and then try not doing that on some sample of questions and see which ones actually get searched for more in aggregate.
Yeah. That's kind of tricky. Well, I'm assuming that Google, if somebody types something in question format, you know, ignores the question words, the how, why, what is the question mark.
I would not think that would be the case, actually. This is one of the reasons why eHow, one of the demand properties, did so freaking well. It's because they basically owned how to blah and how do I blah for pretty much anything like a Kansas school marm could conceive of asking. You know,
how do I, this is my favorite one, how do I boil
a glass of water?
Corn?
How do I file my taxes? How do I donate a car in Kalamazoo? That's an interesting one. You know, how do I donate a car in locality? Like, one single click on an ad on that page is worth, depending on locality, $20. So, you know, you can clearly see why getting that page written for $8 works out great for them.
This is totally crazy. Some of these websites... How to cut a pineapple.com. How to boil corn on the cob.com. These things exist. How to cook corn on the cob.com.
Look, boiling corn on the cob is difficult. I'm glad there's a website about it.
And it's got an advertisement for Seam Web. Just order the corn on the cob.
Now, one of my favorite examples of a site that is both SEO'd and actually useful. If you search for Christmas cookies right now, you're going to get taken to christmas-cookies.com.
I'm doing it. Christmas cookies.
Like, this is a site my SEO buddies and I point to it all the time. It's like they've clearly put some thought into how the SEO works, but it's also by... You know, a noted expert on Christmas cookies, to the extent that anyone can be an expert. She's published books, she appears on TV shows, and the Christmas cookies, like, if you actually go here and try to get a cookie recipe and you make it, it will work, which is not the same if you type how to make Christmas cookies and then get somebody on eHow who is like, you make a cookie and then you stamp
it. which actually is probably a pretty bad idea. Yeah. That is actually very interesting. This is the kind of site that used to be that basically Panda resurfaced these sites, I think, because there used to be millions of these like labors of love or whatever. You know, it's, I'm sure that there's ads on here and stuff, but it's a site by one person that actually knows about this topic, and they've created an awesome site about this topic. And those were what eHow was basically pushing out, basically was dominating, you know, kind of wiping all of those individual sites from 1994 with, you know, these garbage generated sites that were written by freelancers getting paid a dollar to copy things off of the real sites.
Yeah, I think that was certainly a factor for it. I will say one thing for eHow, and this is like a very, 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 you know, 15 asterisks on a qualified defense of them, in that, like, you know, there's a finite amount of labors of love going on the internet, and maybe we don't realize that so much in our techie niche because, you know, there's so many techies and there's so many D&D players and there's so many people who care about, I don't know, computer audio equipment. You would never not have an answer to something. Well, okay, prior to Stack Overflow happening, maybe, but with Stack Overflow, you will never not have an answer for a programming question. But if you have a question that is really only asked by 40-something-year-old school marms in Kansas, it is entirely possible that there is no labor of love site on the internet that exactly answers that question. And for that, Demand
Media
was actually...
They were actually doing something useful, you claim.
Right.
For the first three days of their existence. But they weren't, right? Because they weren't actually doing the research. They were hiring people, paying them $6 to generate the page. And those people used the internet to research their $6 generated page. They didn't go to the library. So the amount, net amount of knowledge added to the internet was guaranteed to be zero. they could only destroy knowledge in their recopying and the researching on the internet.
Well, so like, you know, kind of the Stack Exchange mission statement, right, is answering questions for which there are wrong answers. And there's a lot of things that a school marm in Kansas might need that don't really have a wrong answer. Like, how do you make a paper snowflake? You know.
Okay. How do you make?
I can think of a wrong answer for that.
Paper
snowflake. First, get a car. Drive to the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
Well, like, even someone getting $8, if they describe what happened to them in kindergarten, like, take a piece of paper, fold it, cut stuff. There, you have a paper snowflake. Like, it's very difficult to make an answer to that question that is damagingly wrong. In the same way that, dear God, if they were answering things on health, which was actually a major thing for Demand Media, they were doing, like, health stuff. Like, you know, is it lupus or should I take my child to the hospital if they have a nosebleed? Like, oh God, the existence of that content on the internet physically scares me. But for paper snowflakes and that sort of thing, they might actually have had like a little niche where they, you know, both created value on the internet and maybe didn't screw up people's lives doing it. And that's, you know, this is my very, very, very qualified defense of them. It's not a model that I really love.
Anyway. Onward. Let's move on to the next thing. Enough about Title Quad. I'm not very good at the segues. Jeff, you asked me to put on my list of things to talk about on the podcast, the Ask Me Anything concept.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a neat concept. We're seeing a lot more of this. So this is something that historically, where have you seen it, Joel? Just on Reddit mainly?
Yeah, mostly Reddit. I actually did one somewhere. They asked me to do one on Reddit, and I sat there and answered questions that people asked me about myself.
So let's clarify. So there's two categories on Reddit. If we look at Reddit as the sort of the progenitor of this, the IMA and then the IAMA. It's just, these acronyms are crazy. And then Ask Me Anything.
IMA. Yeah. Well, it's supposed to be like IMA, blah, Ask Me Anything. No, there's no difference. You're just like IMA, garbage truck operator, Ask Me Anything. That's supposed to be the idea, is that you sort of express who you are.
It is neat because let's say you could ask someone, you know, super famous about something, you know, really, really interesting that they've done. This is definitely has appeal. Or, you know, something really mundane that's still weird, like, hey, I was a prostitute, ask me something. I mean, it's interesting, right? On some level.
Right.
And I always thought the Reddit format, as with so many things on Reddit, the format kind of hurt it. Like, I think a lot of Reddit's, I know a lot of people like Reddit's, this is a little bit sacrilegious, but I find the format really damaging. Like, I just can't read Reddit. It's very painful. But somebody started a website, AnyAsk, A-N-Y-A-S-Q. Is that correct, Joel? Let me make sure I'm saying this correctly. AnyAsk. Yeah, there it is. AnyAsq.com. And they kind of hoisted the format out of the not-so-great layout on Reddit. But it's the same basic concept. You know, you have these people that are famous for something, or they're interesting because of something. And then people just ask them a bunch of questions, and you vote up the questions. And like, I think the most popular one is somebody who worked on Google Plus, and the answers are useful. That's what I like about it. When I look at web pages, I like entertainment. Don't get me wrong. I love LOLcat as much as anyone. But when I look at pages, I think, you know, what can I learn from this? How can this help me get better at something? And a lot of these are interesting, like the Google Plus one. You're learning like sort of how they built Google Plus, some of the things they're going to bring to it. One of the questions that somebody tried to put on our network was, what did they use to build Google Plus, which is radically off topic for us, but it's great for this. It's perfect for this. And that's like the number one question. So I was encouraged to see that was a legitimate question, but it didn't really have a place to live on our network. So it's nice that there are other places to put questions like that. So
yeah, we keep talking about the Quora in that regard, whereas the Quora, the Quora is a place where a lot of times the person answering the question is what actually makes the answer useful. Somebody might have a particular perspective that is interesting because of who they are, what they know, and the question may be utterly boring except for the person who's answering it, or just like kind of like, you know, who cares? But when you see who answers it, that may be valuable.
Right.
I'm just reading the Ask Me Anything I did on Reddit. What would you say is the number one thing that Reddit gets wrong? So the very number one question was like, so enough about you. Tell us about Reddit.
Great.
There it is. If you were in charge of Reddit, what would you change? Yeah, that one was kind of stupid. There's sort of a lot of useful stuff there. And a lot of times it's just like, hey, this person is a celebrity. But more often than not, it's just, you know, here's a person who has life experience that you might be kind of intrigued by. I wonder what it's like to be that kind of person. Alex, hit the mute button.
The other thing I want to mention that I like about AnyAsq, AnyAsk.com, is it's a very flat layout. What drives me crazy about Reddit is this idea that I want to read a threaded discussion. Where all of a sudden it's just pushing so far to the right, it's like I don't even care anymore.
Well, that's
it's going
the
off on these tangents that totally don't matter. Whereas here, this is much more like it's like a Stack Exchange model. It's like you start with a question, then answer, and it's
you're right. They copied our little up arrows and our down arrows.
Not exactly, but and then I like that on the sidebar it has, okay, here's the upcoming questions that, you know, we think this person should answer next.
What question the person That's interesting. Do people have to answer all the questions? Because the great thing about the Ask Me Anything on Reddit is that I didn't have to answer anyone that I didn't feel like answering, even though it was Ask Me Anything. But then the people would tend to vote up the ones that I had answered. So, you know, if I ignored one, it wouldn't be sort of stuck like a sore thumb at the top with me just ignoring it and refusing to answer it. It would sort of tend to disappear to the bottom. So basically things that people wanted me to answer. And like, I don't know that the Reddit model is so broken for Ask Me Anything. This might be a little bit better.
I think it's profoundly broken. I can't even read it. I mean, this is so much better. Like, just changing the layout is everything here. You could take the exact same content and put it in this format, and it would be 10 times better. But, I mean, maybe that's just...
It's clean, but it's not like if you're a Reddit person, then you don't really see all the Reddit craft that you're just used to.
Yeah, because there's some stupid joke that goes on for 20 lines and goes way off to the right that's awesome for you. It's like, you're repeating a line from a movie. Then I'll repeat a line from a movie. Then you'll repeat a line from the movie. It's like, awesome. Yeah, it's like, get this out of my face. If I could delete that page from the internet, I would.
Well, you don't like Reddit. That's okay. But for people that like Reddit, that stuff's fine.
I know. It's entertainment. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just it gets in the way of the information. Like, if this guy was actually on Reddit and they were doing that, I would be pissed off. I'm like, look, this is a useful thing and you've polluted it with your stupidity. I guess this is where I put on my Paul Graham hat, right?
Yeah.
And I say, okay, this is more like Hacker News. This is serious business, right? And we're doing serious things with serious people here. Did you see one thing that's worth mentioning, since, you know, Hacker News is kind of like Reddit with some of the stuff changed to make it more information dense. They got rid of displaying upvotes, and that's kind of sticking, isn't it? They no longer display upvotes. Like when I go to a random Hacker News
thing. It's interesting, actually. You can see upvotes on your own thing that you wrote.
Of course.
If you write something, you can see how many people voted it up. and things are still ranked by number of votes, so you can tell what's good, but you can't see how many votes other people got. I think that ruined Hacker News. Ruined it. Really? They need to fix it.
It's sticking, though, is my point. Is like, I think they try
it's
this
just
stuff.
It's sticking because Paul Graham did it, and then he was like, yeah, okay, I guess it's better. But I don't think he pays as much attention to Hacker News as he pays attention to other things. And this, for one, drives me crazy because, and I'll tell you why, a lot of the value from Hacker News came from the information that was, what do other people think about this comment? Because if you assume that the Hacker News base knows something, I mean, if you think about it, if you remove that from Stack Overflow, you still listed it in order, but you remove the number of votes, you just kind of can't tell, like, is this right? You see somebody writing something, and you say, wait, could that possibly be right? I don't know. And you want the information of, like, what do some smart people here think? Well, I think it's a, yeah, it's real, there's a real loss of information there when you don't know, you don't have everybody basically voting on what the best answer is. I mean, they're voting and it's sorting, but you don't really see, like, what do people think about this? So I'll give you a couple of examples on Hacker News. Somebody writes something that is snotty and rude, and you can't see that it was voted down. So you think,
it'll still turn gray if it gets downvoted.
Well, okay, if it's voted down, if it's actually like getting minuses and stuff like that. But, a lot of times you see three or four comments, maybe it's a new thing. Some of them are smart and some of them are stupid. And you just sort of wonder about the audience. Whereas it used to be that you were like, oh, this is a really smart audience. This is awesome. And you got a lot of signal out of how many votes up something got. Well, sometimes, you got comfort. Somebody would write something that seems kind of dumb, and then you would reply to it, and you would see that the dumb person got one upvote and that you got 14 upvotes. And you'd be like, okay, I'm not crazy here. I'm actually right because I got 14 upvotes and he got one upvote. And that signal is now gone. You can't see that at all. It's just missing.
Well, so I think that's also useful in kind of conveying community norms to new members of the community. Like, if you're not really a talker, you don't really get a sense these days of the sort of things that Hacker News values in response. Like, you know, the little one-liner Redditism is not what we kind of consider as normative. We'd rather have someone maybe talk a little more length, not go for the pithy response, and attempt to add value. And there's I'm kind of agnostic on the change myself, but I think there's sort of anecdotally more people coming in these days who are giving Reddit-esque responses and then not adjusting to negative feedback over their next few weeks of use of it.
Or lack of positive feedback. That's my point. When Joel stated it in terms of, okay, imagine the typical Stack Overflow question, but you just can't see any of the voting. Well, you're seeing a sort order, but you have no idea if that's based on zero votes or thousands of votes. And that's actually or negative votes, right? So you're losing... Joel's point is completely valid. You're seeing a sort order, so you're getting the value out of that, but you don't know if it's backed by actual data, which is kind of crippling. What actually might be a better compromise, now that I've thought this through, Joel, is just showing, once it has a certain number of votes, just showing, okay, this has enough votes. Like this karma cap that I think Slashdot did first, where once you have a certain amount of karma, you just have enough karma.
Well, what Slashdot has is it's up to 5 votes and then that stops, right? Like it shows you basically 0 to 5 and then it's just once it gets 5 stars, that's all you care about.
Well, that would kind of solve, it's kind of a half step, but it would solve the problem of, A, you don't know how, if there's any signal, it could be 0 votes, right?
But then you're
not getting this, okay, pile-on effect of, oh, this has 300 upvotes. Well, I better upvote it too because, gosh, everybody loves this thing.
I don't think people do that. People are very strong-willed on the internet. They need to be consulted. They have their very strong opinion. I don't think the pile-on effect is a real thing, personally. Like, I mean, I it happens. I don't think there's any problem there. It doesn't bother me that things get linked to from Reddit and then we all of a sudden get 800 upvotes on an otherwise completely boring topic. Doesn't bother me because, to me, it's just serving so many more people that it deserves some extra upvotes. It's just valuable to more people.
Another complaint that we often get, in fact, somebody just emailed me about this the other day, is you have a post that has a lot of history and has a lot of 30 upvotes on one of the answers. Then you have another answer that comes along that's really very, very good, but it sort of languishes at the bottom of the sort order. Now, granted, you can change the sort order, but the default sort order is by votes. It's like, how do you catch up to 30 votes? So if you compress the range...
Ah,
like,
yes, that's true.
There's no such thing as 30 votes. There's just 1 to 5. And once you get to 5, you're the max.
That's so a really, something... well, yeah. But there's still going to be a better answer.
Trade-offs. There's no
I think what we're doing
system.
Is fine. But I do agree about that. It's sometimes something gets 30 upvotes and it's just not that good. And it takes a long time to build up more votes on a lower reputation thing. And I should bring up, like, the way I solve that is I tweet my answer and then everybody comes in and I get 100 upvotes from people that follow me on Twitter. But that's a little bit cheating because everybody can't do
that. That was also a very, very good answer that you gave. I mean, you're not giving yourself enough credit.
That's true, but I can probably get my Twitter or followers to vote on things. But you're right. And but the way that Hacker News does that, which is actually kind of interesting, is something we never do, but they do, which is that if you have a lot of reputation and you submit a new answer to something, even if it's if that thing has been there for a while, they give you more time at the top. So you get kind of more exposure at the top. And it used to be that you could see that it had zero votes. I don't think that it is anymore. I think that was sort of a weird side effect of this latest change of not showing the number of votes. So essentially, you'd be looking down the list and you'd see the first answer would have zero votes and it'd still be at the top. And you'd be like, why is that at the top? And it would simply be based on the reputation of that user that they got an extra bump on their question for a while. They got to spend more time at the top because they had such a high reputation. Which
that's another reason to suppress. That's another reason to suppress the scores, though, because if you are gonna, that actually does make sense because the tyranny of the sword order is really profound. I mean, how do you combat the sword order? And you almost have to do stuff like that because if we did that on Stack Overflow, the amount of bugs we would get open on that—it's like this zero-voted post is above the post with 10 votes. This is a bug.
Yeah. Right?
So that would prevent all the bugs.
You might want to highlight it as like new answer or something, so you don't even see the number of votes for a while. It just says new. In that particular case, you got an up arrow and a down arrow, and you can click the up arrow, and it works. But instead of showing the number of votes on that particular one, it just sort of shows the word new. So you're like, okay, this thing is here because it's new. And also, incidentally, because the person who wrote it has high reputation. And, you know, to some extent, there's a very high probability that somebody either with a high reputation or a high average reputation, you know, you go on the average number of points that they got on their answer. You know, there's a high probability that that's a good answer that you want people to spend some time with and to consider.
Right. No, I think that's a great idea. It's just a matter of, you know, folding into our system. I do think that Paul Graham has a lot of really good thoughts on this stuff. Like, I know you don't like his change, but I think he's smart enough not to make changes that...
Podcast, Alex, producer Alex, put him on the list. We'll invite him to the podcast.
Okay.
I can't upload a picture into the chat room. What's going on? I wanted to upload a picture. We'll put it in the show notes, but basically... we have a math intern here, and he's done some analysis, and you know, one of the things that a lot of people tell us is, why do you have all those points? Nobody cares about their reputation. That's stupid. You're making an immature, childish little game. Nobody's influenced by that. And other people tell us, you know, only about 10 to 50% of people in a given game will even be playing the game. The rest of it will just be ignoring it. But we have a statistic that that Cao Chu, our math intern, found about what happens when somebody writes an answer. What is the probability that they will return to post again on our site? I think within the next 4 weeks. I don't remember the exact details of how he phrased it, but basically, given that somebody has just written an answer, what are the chances that they will return to post again? They will essentially come back and spend more time on our site. If the answer that they wrote got downvoted, the chances that they will write something else are 12%. If the answer got no votes, the chances that they'll return are 20%. If it got upvoted, even a single upvote, the chances that they'll return go up to 45%. And if their answer was accepted, the chances that they'll return and post again got up to 58%. So basically, they can get four stimuli, you know, there's basically four things that our system does to them when they post their answer. You know, we either punish them by downvoting them, in which case there's only a 12% chance, you know, all the way up to, you know, the answer gets accepted and they get a green checky, and then there's a 58% chance. So it's basically almost five times greater probability that they will return to our site if their answer was beloved and they got that positive feedback, no matter how utterly and completely and mindlessly meaningless it is to get an upvote. It does actually have meaning, and it does dramatically influence people's behavior. So we see a really, really strong effect, which we've never measured. We've only known about that our voting system is doing something to, at least to teach people the right behavior, or possibly just to take the stupid people and make them run away.
Right. I don't know about the direction of causality there, because it could be that people who are you know, might be more invested in the topic or knowledgeable about the topic are both likely to come back because, wow, you know, new site on programming that I get to talk at, yay. And also more likely to get upvoted because they, you know, have some clue versus someone who wants to, how do I sum all the elements of an array in Java?
Yeah, could be.
But actually, I wanted to, so this interview was originally scheduled for like 2 weeks from now, and I downloaded a thing on the your guys' dump. I had a question in mind and I wanted to do some research on it, but not done yet. But my hypothesis was that like people who like you have hyper contributing outliers on Stack Overflow, just like I'm, you know, the crazy always posting guy on Hacker News. You guys got like John Skeet and company who they post thousands of great answers on any topic under the sun for their languages. And I'm thinking that those kind of people like disproportionately influence the first experience someone has with your site. Like if you ask a question on .NET, all things being equal, you're probably more likely to get a response from John Skeet than from, you know, random poster number 123. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you break down the people who get their first, like their first interaction with the site is, bam, John Skeet has just written you a thesis on this.
But wait, they're new on the site. They don't even know who John Skeet is. Are you just they saying don't that know. This is, he writes really good quality answers?
Right. He writes great quality answers. And, okay. You know, it's like, I think that my hypothesis, again, no data for this yet, is that someone would be more likely to come back if they got, like, the Skeet Bible on, you know, how to, I don't know, sort of hash table in .NET versus someone else who just said, yeah, you can kind of do that, and then just wrote out, like, two sentences, and maybe, like, yeah, it answers the question, but it doesn't answer it to the degree that he might have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the probability of people coming back with answers with questions. So this was people writing answers. So might get slightly different results of people asking questions. And and I would expect that obviously if they ask a question and don't get a response, which is actually relatively rare on our system for somebody to not get an answer. We do have an 80% answer rate on our worst site, so.
Well, one thing, the stats were a little weird there. John Skeet, as prolific as he is very much a drop in the bucket. It's a very large site now. I mean, that's odds true, that you'll get an answer by John Skeet are actually not that good. The odds that you'll get a good answer, I like to think, are actually quite good. Now, if you ask me a question, you know, there's a garbage in, garbage out factor there. But I think that the way to think of that, maybe, Patrick, is if you get a quality answer, which I think you're likely to.
Well, if we don't scope it just to John Skeet, like, you know, how much percentage of your user base would it take to, say, cover like 50% of the answered questions? Would it be like, you know, probably 5%, 8%, somewhere in there?
It's kind of a fatter tail than you think, but I don't know the actual answer.
Oh, okay.
There are certainly the whales. I mean, I think there's really two audiences that you serve. One is the really people that are addicted to the system, that really get a lot out of it. And for good reason. I mean, I read in an interview you did, you were a guild master in World of Warcraft, so you sort of know what it feels like to have time be spent and sort of disappear from the world.
Yep.
So ultimately, it's in service of this higher calling of learning, so they're getting something out of it. So I don't feel bad about that. Like, if versus somebody who's addicted to being in a casino would be way worse for society. It's like being addicted to Stack Overflow. If that's the worst thing that happens to you, you're still doing quite well in the big scheme of things. But it is true that, particularly on the smaller sites, the last time we looked at this, it was basically like a core of maybe, I want to say, a couple hundred users on our largest sites are really doing a huge percentage of the work in the system. So that is true in the aggregate. It's not just John Skeet. It's John Skeet and like 100 of his buddies.
There's always a power law, but then there's sort of a surprising number of people who contribute at all. Like it's not, even on some of the sites, like we have a few sites where the number of people that post four times a month is surprisingly low, like under 10 people post four times a month on some of our smallest Stack Exchanges. And yet there's still a lot of people coming in posting every day, even if there's nobody who's a regular. So without actually having any data, I would say that there's just a bit of a fat tail there.
That's a good thing to look at, though, Patrick. I mean, we can have Chichu look at that, or, you know, if you want to spelunk the data, And you need something from us, just let me know. We have an NDA that people can sign if you need more.
Don't forget to sign up for Stack Overflow Dev Days at devdays.stackoverflow.com. An awesome 2-day conference where you'll learn a whole bunch of stuff. We're coming to Sydney, Australians. You need to get out there and sign up. Otherwise, we're not coming. London, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco all in the fall. Jeff and I will be at many of them. Jeff, which ones are you coming to?
I haven't fully decided yet.
Not fully decided. So that means that you now want to go on the Twitter and tell Coding Horror that he needs to come to your city. I'll be at all of them because I love flying around on airplanes. So devdays.stackoverflow.com. The whole thing. Thank you very much for listening to Stack Exchange Podcast number 12 with our special guest, Patrick McKenzie, who you can find at. Patrick, where is your website where people should go to look for all the wonderful things that you've done on the internet?
My blog is at Kalzumeus, Kalzumeus.com.
Kalzumeus.com, and also Bingo Card Creator and AppointmentReminder.org, and as Patio11 on the Twitter and the Hacker News. And just reading Patrick's comments on Hacker News is probably a good use of your time if you're bored. We'll be back next week with graphic designer Jin Yang, who is the guy that designs all those awesome Stack Exchange websites. So we'll see you next week. We'll be right back.